Well, I want to welcome everyone to the Helen S. Schaefer Building. This is home of the Poetry Center and the Humanities Seminars Program. I'm Gail Brown, Executive Director of the Poetry Center. I see we got another group coming in, so I'm just going to pause here for a second and resume in a minute while these folks get seated. It's really gratifying to see so many different groups of people in the audience tonight, this afternoon rather. We have students, former students, faculty, I think maybe not just from English, but from some other departments across the College of Humanities, and of course our friends and patrons of the Poetry Center. It's nice to see you all here. And what? Old folks. I didn't say that, Liz. It didn't come out of my mouth. You all should have bio sheets. The sort of more formal biographies of our panelists are here. This is the first of a series of events we hope to do with faculty from the Creative Writing Program. So let's get started. We have a nice program, and let's get going. Once you've settled yourselves like books about you, this is a title from a poem by Barbara Cully in her book, The New Intimacy. I have a feeling she may have had these words in mind when she suggested today's panel to me. Our conversations over the years have often touched on the subject of identities. The writer self, the teacher self, the self as citizen of the world, and the different types of engagement those identities elicit from us. So a life in letters is, in Barbara's mind and in mine, an opportunity for students to learn more about the work and working lives of their teachers and mentors, and for our various communities to engage with the poets they have read and admired for years. So please do gather yourself like books about you and welcome poet, lecturer, teacher, Poetry Center Advisory Board member, and friend, Barbara Cully.
Thank you, Gail. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Our illustrious panel of poets will be introduced by some of their former students. Simmons Button will introduce Allison Deming. And needs a microphone.
And we're just doing this from the audience, I understand. So should I sneak back over here? Maybe I'll stand up. Hi, I'm Simmons. And I would like to direct you this afternoon to the virtual Allison Hawthorne Deming. That's an Allison I'm very familiar with because I've helped in crafting her website. And if you've been to her website, which is at AllisonHawthorneDeming.com, you will find that there are a series of quotes that rotate on the homepage. And I'd like to just read real briefly from one of those. What it takes to dazzle us, masters of dazzle, all of us here together at the top of the world, is a night without neon or mercury lamps. Respectfully to Allison, I disagree. I think what it takes to dazzle us is an outstanding teacher, an excellent writer, and an amazing person. And I have been dazzled by Allison really since I first met her several years ago when we met to discuss the MFA program. And I was trying to decide whether I should apply to poetry or nonfiction. I'd already met with Steve, but I wanted to really talk about content versus form and a few other things. And I'll tell you, again, I was dazzled from the beginning. When I entered the MFA program, and I worked with Allison both in nonfiction and poetry, I became further dazzled, further enamored. Sorry, you see, I can't even talk about it. I've been so dazzled, so enamored that my wife got a little bit nervous, actually. She said, she sort of approached me point blank and said, is this something that I need to be worried about? She had not yet met Allison, in fact. And I said, well, I understand what your concern is. And not long after, fortunately, we had a potluck at our home, and Allison and many other folks came over. And she said, okay, I completely understand why you are so exuberant about Allison, because she is just such a wonderful person. And there are a few people, I think, who have such an energy, such a passion. I mean, Allison and these people are every bit as mortal as the rest of us. And yet, when you're around them, they lift you up, and it's kind of a wild, kind of a dizzying, but yet still a delightful ride. And Allison is one of those people. It's evident in her poetry, but more so, I think, in her personality, whether in the classroom or not. So I don't think I could ask for anything more than to be dazzled. I certainly couldn't have hoped for more than a teacher, a mentor, and a friend than what Allison gives. And so I expect when we hear from her today, we all, too, will be dazzled. So really, it's my pleasure to introduce the wonderful, the inspiring, and the, of course, dazzling Allison Hawthorne Deming.
Do I have to start over?
No, thank you.
Okay. Well, that just ruined the whole moment. Sorry, Jane. Okay. Anyway. All right. So Coachella Valley, palm trees. You guys got it. Okay. So the trees are like big furry monsters from your childhood, the cuddly kind. And after walking around a bit, hidden from the sun by this huge palm nest, you ultimately drive or hike back to where you came from, back into the aridness. And you are invigorated by this apparition of life, this entrancing, important fissure in the earth that created some wondrous oasis. Jane has the same effect for me. Like the oasis, it's hard to tell if Jane is truly there in front of you at the time. Only later do you know some piece has been put into motion. The fault is shifted. When I was in my first semester as an MFA student, I felt like Jane was going to cut my head off and hand it back to me with the big, dark truth. And of course, what the hell is the truth? But it felt fantastic. And so lucky am I to have Jane as teacher, mentor, reader, confidant. She cultivates presence like no one else. I want to share a quote from one of Jane's interviews. It reads, "Really, writers are still at that primal confrontation. What is this body I am dealing with? Where in the vast, emotional, immature self is the one unsentimental deed that will access language of great refinement?" Yes, these are the questions, and here is the fault line. Everyone, Jane Miller.
I'm still here, Steve. Good afternoon. I spent a lot of years not understanding my father. He was hardworking to the point of absence, brooding, quick to anger. But every now and then, usually after a drink or two, he would sit my brother and me down at the dining room table and tell us stories of his childhood. Some careening narrative starring young country boys long since dead and the mischief they caused. And my father would often stop, laugh to himself as if coming to terms with something he had forgotten, then take another drink and continue to confuse us. I didn't understand Steve when I first met him either. But over the years of reading his poetry and occasionally being fortunate enough to sit down with him over a drink, he has taught me how to be a more patient reader and a more patient listener. His poetry is at times blunt, wry, sad, but always beautiful in its ability to place you in the midst of several emotions at once. Steve is one of the few poets that pisses me off and awes and humbles me in the space of a few well-crafted lines. His poetry forces you to be patient, not to give you answers, but questions that help you navigate you through your own experiences in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Orland.
Can you hear me all right? Excellent. I've had the pleasure of knowing Boyer Rickle for several years now, initially as his student in the MFA program, as someone he invited to co-teach an undergraduate class, and then as his friend. As his student in the graduate program, I quickly learned that Boyer is immensely attuned to the cadence and music of a piece of writing. He has an incredible ear for sound, the most developed and focused of anyone I've met. And he helps develop that ear in everyone he works with. I later learned that his parents taught music, clearly a contributing factor to his awareness of the music and language. Boyer is precise, careful, and a meticulous writer who often uses disciplined processes repeated over time to produce and craft his writing. This practice has produced, among his other works, Remnants, which is a gorgeously lyric and meditative book of poetry that offers much to come back to time and time again. He is a detailed and insightful reader who is both gracious and liberal with his feedback. Boyer is also a caring, genuine, and wonderful human being. He's immensely generous in both his mentorship and teaching and in his friendship. There are many of us in this room today who count him as an integral part of our writing community. We're extremely blessed to have him here affiliated with the university and our creative writing program. It's my absolute pleasure and honor to introduce Boyer Rickle.
When asked what poetry is, Dylan Thomas replied that a poem is like a city having many entrances. Poetry is the apex of culture, the spire of civilizations, the scalpel of emotion, and the anvil of thought, whispering and bellowing the unsayable with mere words. I'm going to add another quote, one that you might be familiar with. The distinction between the personal and the political gives the political realm too much and too little scope. At the same time, it renders the personal too important and not important enough. We need a third term, one that can describe the space between the state and the supposedly safe havens of the personal. Let us call this space the social. The social is a place of struggle, where books are published, courses are taught, and poems disseminated. It is a sphere in which, end quote, and that's from Carolyn Forché, a sphere in which we, this building, and this conversation reside. This panel was inspired with MFA students in mind because they sought you out. They crossed rivers and mountains to study at your feet. But the audience is everyone. Does poetry matter to the world and in it? This is as much a question for us, the audience, as it is for our four illustrious panel of poets. The building we are in answers yes. The students who have come to learn and earn advanced degrees in poetry have answered yes. The university institution as a whole, by housing the poetic enterprise within its enterprise, has answered yes as well. A well-remembered poet, Larry Levis, said yes by saying, "Ecstasy is just as much a birthright in this world as misery is a condition of it." How do we nod our own yes to poetry while saying yes to everything else we love? And where do we put it? Next to everything else we love? Our poet teachers have managed this negotiation over a lifetime, measuring themselves out not with Prufrock's coffee spoons, but with the individual letters becoming books, one digital, lyrical, cognitive gesture at a time, and we are grateful. The hope of this event is to prompt the individual and collective reflections about how these poets have made their choices. Aesthetic, philosophical, pedagogical, over years and careers, but equally true, less lofty and more humble. We are here because of a loneliness for and a deep love of the conversation. I've overprepared. So the Cully Seminar version of this event will appear next time I teach a graduate course in poetry. Today, the floor and microphones belong to the poets. I've prepared a set of questions. I'm hoping that more than one of you will answer each question so the similarities and disagreements among you will emerge. The premise here is as ambitious as it is confident. What you have to say, what you have written, thought, and done will inform us not only about you, but about the origins and destinations of poetry in our times. Thank you each for coming. And to start, what would you like to read to us of the books we have on the table or that you brought? I've put little post-its in some of your books, and I've put some of your books with those post-its right in front of you. But I know that you have brought some work and that you might have some planning that you did on your own. So ignore my post-its. It's just part of my, we'll call it process or diagnosis. But before starting with the questions, let's just hear a poem. And start with Jane. Because she has a mic down there.
How's that? Okay. This is for Valentine's Day coming up for all of you. And the poem is called A Little Myth. A little myth about me standing below a window shouting, Valentina, Valentina, until I'm joined by a couple of friends who happen by and others on their way to dinner end up joining in the melody. Valentina, who apparently is not home. I announce there is no Valentina. There never was. A little perturbed but forgiving, the crowd dissolves into night mist. But one last voice stays and tries again, Valentina! It amounts to so little, yet poetry remains on nearly every corner calling.
Down the row? All right. Metaleptic. Emotions float. The fish's motion is its thought. Unknown forms embedded in stone invite our guesses at things, at origins. Some ancients believed the soul adheres to bones. Each surface is a depth, like corpuscence, a glow that's cold, its source invisible. Whispers at a wall, audible, yards distant. Seabob of cormorants, a circling whale. What we take on faith that waves approaching shore advance is pattern, not displacement, like wind. The rose a magnet makes of iron filings. Earth warms, fireflies no longer light a river's turns. What shakes the heart at the scent of skin? Love stings, love swings, love rings, love strings, love wings.
I came off a long period, or several months anyways, of writing lyric poems, which were in this book. And when I was able to start up again, I gave vent to my narrative, long-winded pieces. This is called The Last Train. She took me on my first train trip, the last time a train would take the twice daily 40-mile trip from Holyoke to Hartford and back. I was very small and don't remember much, except my mother had a sense of occasion. And though we weren't Catholic or rich, she dressed me up as though we were going to the Easter parade. Gray day, light rain, the depot crowded with the smells that would be gone in an hour. Across the street, the tenements. They'd always been there. Down Railroad Street, the canal, and even in the rain, men would have been fishing, and because it was Saturday, fishing with their sons. I don't remember boarding the train or what passed in the window frames. She probably squealed for joy when we crossed the Connecticut River, because she always referred to it as my river. And a week before she died, she said, "That's one thing they can't take away from me." I remember tugging at her sleeve, we were in Hartford by then, standing on the platform, and pointing. She bent and whispered that it's impolite to point. I imagine this journey meant the end of an era to her, and though she wasn't a particularly reflective person, she was sentimental, meaning she had an acute awareness of the passage of time and how it affected her. And the era that was passing on a single day, a Saturday in 1947, was a memory she spoke of often. As a little girl standing with her father in front of the small depot, holding a sign, "Rooms to Let." I was pointing at a black boy about my own age. I'd never before seen a black person. I didn't know what to think or say. She said he was a Negro. That's all she said. I remember that the Negro boy, who must have seen plenty of white people in his brief life, was pointing back at me. He was smiling. When someone smiles and you don't know why, you join in anyway. We each held our mother's hand. I imagine the boy's mother caught my mother's eyes. And because they were both good people, both polite, and aware of what can pass between people at moments like this, also smiling.
It's so intriguing to have Barbara put these post-its. I'd love to read something, but I think I'll follow what my pals have done and read something new. This is called The Prisoner. The municipal gardener planted a laurel outside the county jail. He placed it beneath the window, bars cutting up the light on the ground he worked. The prisoner could catch a whiff of fragrance for 1 week, the musk of spring. When the prisoner was released, the gardener happened to be kneeling, pulling weeds, invisible to everyone but himself. He glanced up to watch the prisoner cross the threshold to freedom, saw him pause, arrested by the fragrance he'd known in captivity. I know a prisoner, one who stays locked in her mind. No movie more compelling than the suspense of what one moment will do to the last and the next. The real plot unfolding in a theater where nothing happens but this separation of herself into parts that are not parts, but only the whole that feels partitioned. The argument that she should not feel a certain way, though feeling comes without pre-existing conditions, covenants, exclusions. You will not feel lonely. You will not feel angry. You will not feel lost when love abandons you. Sensible shoes and sensible goals, little dreamer. Come back to the bars on the windows and doors. This is the play of her mind, enthusiasm meeting antagonist, the scent of laurel caught in the neuron net.
Thank you. The questions I have come in four different categories, and the first is the life. Each of these poets have lived a life as an artist in the context of the academic setting, and each have made their aesthetic choices inside the community that they work in and give their work to. The first question I have about the life is your poetry the byproduct of a life, or the engine of one? And I think, Jane, you and I have talked about this a little bit, so I thought you might want to take this on. But there are other... No, and I wouldn't either. That would be redundant, especially in public.
Well, for me, the answer is that it is... very much. I guess I'm just a writer by accident, and I consider myself a lover with many failures and a few successes, but with that as the engine of my life. And writing is kind of on the side of all of that, and I do it very infrequently. And when I do, I try to disappear in to get it over with as fast as I can so I can come back to my life. I realize that it is a part of my life, but it's very small. I love words, and I love people who use words even more. So.
Nice, thank you. Who would you like to answer that question next?
Who would I?
Yeah.
I guess I'd love to hear Boyer's answer.
Boyer, is your poetry the byproduct of a life or the engine of one?
Oh, those are hard metaphors to attach to.
And you can discard them.
I do, yeah.
For your own.
I mean, there is such an integration for me of the experience of my community and the writing that I do that it's hard for me to separate them. I can't imagine the life without the writing, but I would never have arrived at the community without poetry and the opportunity for teaching. I know that when I was in a very low place in my life 7 or 8 years ago and was not writing, it was through a relationship of language and imagination that a student who became a close friend brought me to that restored me to my writing. So it's a very complicated relationship for me. And if I'm not writing, I don't feel terribly alive, actually. It's extremely important to me to be sort of engaged with language and imagination at all times in relation to the world that I experience. And so I wish there were a way to create a sort of hybrid of the things that those two metaphors suggest. Because that's how it would be for me. Mm-hmm. Softy.
And you don't have to answer it, Steve, if you don't want to. I can give you a different question.
No, I like it.
You liked it.
Yeah. I can, because you can throw anything in there.
Yeah.
Into that question, I mean. Poetry is just the whole thing for me. Except for my wife and son and drinks with my friends. I don't want to leave. My wife and I are the same way. About this. We both just like to do our work all the time. And then it's like parallel play, you know. Mm-hmm. And so she likes to be inside her imagination all the time, which is visual, and I like to be inside my verbal one as many hours a day as I can do it, which is 6, 7, 8. And I was born, this sounds like more than I mean it to sound, but in a sense I was born to be a writer of some kind, as I was born with, like my father and my son, with the ability to use language and grammar and spelling without having to study it, and also just to love words right away. My father sent me the dictionary all the time, and I love the sound of them. What made me different from my father was that he had no sensibility. He had no particularly well-examined inner life, and like many of our fathers, but I was born with that. I mean, I started to grow into that terrible confusion that you have in childhood of trying to figure things out in some way, and you have nothing, no experience yet to help you with all of that. And that produces the alienation, I think, that's common to many writers. And it also produced in me the desire to try to understand how people live. I felt like I didn't know how to be. And so my poems began that way, was trying to figure out how other people live so I could learn how to live. And for the most part, I haven't stopped my engagement with that. So it's my engine. Everything else is... lard. I don't know.
Well, I guess maybe fuel. I don't like engine or byproduct, but I'll take fuel. I think, I mean, my writing is really, really central to my life. It's what gives me energy and a sense of direction, a sense of having a shred of hope that I might resolve many of the confusions that I live with all the time, which all of us live with. I mean, I love what Steve says about the terrible confusion of childhood. I felt that way in my childhood so profoundly, and I think books saved me, reading saved me. I saw things that I was experiencing in my inner life kind of lifting off of pages, and it was remarkable. So I fell in love with language because of that, and you know, for me, I don't write all the time. I always have a lot of writing projects going, either poetry or nonfiction. And I go through periods where it's really hard to find the time to write. But it's really central to my sense of who I am, my trajectory, my sense of balance, my sense of place in the world. And I don't separate it out like, oh, there's teaching and writing. One of my teachers way back at Stanford, W.S.D. Pieros, you know, I said, oh, I have this terrible struggle between work and what I have to do for money and my writing. He said, why is it a struggle? It's all one thing. And, you know, I've tried for a long time to feel that that was true. And all of a sudden, it does feel true. It is all one thing, and it's all fuel.
When reading your work, Allison, I notice a tension in it that you make very good aesthetic use of, which seems like a tension that, like you're saying, exists in your life as well. And the way I characterize that is the tension between knowing and mystery and not knowing and solving and witnessing and healing, enigma and documentary. And this notion of solving for X or not, and as an alternative, allowing the dissolution of all things to happen around you. And I felt very much that there was no distinction between the art and the life in looking at your books over the course of my review of them, especially as you have written your most recent work. It seems like that is a dominant theme. In terms of the integration of the life and the aesthetic, I have a question for Boyer that goes into the aesthetic realm, because it seems like if we look at your work, Boyer, we've got a kind of sea change, maybe almost literally sea. Because I know that you like to hang out at the water's edge. And I was wondering if you could, in continuing your discussion of, you know, the art and the life being so integrated, where then does this transformation, the sea change that appears in the work, come from?
Teaching and my students. About 16 years ago, 18 years ago, Steve said, you need to teach the forms course. It's your turn. And I don't know if he was just bored with it, or because he had taught it so much, or he had some better project. And I didn't, of course, want to do it because I didn't know what it was about. And so I started teaching that course with the notion that I was just a student at the table. And I still very much teach that course as a student at the table, because I'm not, I don't have a deep writing history in the traditions of form and traditional English prosody, but I love it. And the first four or five times that I taught the course, I did the assignments every week. I wrote the sonnets and the villanelles and the horrible blank verse poems, and I put them on the worksheets not to be discussed, but just as a form of demonstrating, you know, that I was in the middle of this humiliating experience with my students. They could see how I was struggling with the forms. But what I discovered was that I love having a set of conventions to work through. So often those formal conventions led me into places imaginatively and intellectually and emotionally that I don't think I would have gotten to if I didn't have the conventions to consider and to constantly be sort of working in tension at some level against. And it led me to think about creating my own conventions. poems that would be written in series so that I would find out how my mind, when writing in series, fell into patterns, and then I could challenge those patterns. And at the same time that I was beginning to realize that I could work in a new way that would actually give me more work to do, rather than each poem being a reinvention of myself as a poet, which is the way I had worked for so many years, poets in my classes started taking me to new poets that I might not have gotten to. And I started rereading poets that I'd always loved but not quite understood why and what it was about them that I found ungraspable and yet necessary in my reading of them. So Ray Armantrout, Peter Gizzi, there are so many poets now who are central to my love of contemporary poetry that were brought to me by my students. And at the time I was seeing how these new sort of forms of imagination were functioning, I was trying to overlay them with these personal conventions and these forms. And that's how it happened. I mean, I can't imagine how I would have gotten into the place of the sequences that I've been working on without that interplay of the life of teaching a course that I was forced to teach, and these amazing students who came in and took me in directions I don't know that I would have gotten to.
Steve, all of your poems are moving, and I mean that in both senses of the word. They move on the page, they tell stories, and they also move us emotionally. For example, the poem "The Pripet Marshes," you remember that one? It might have ended after the first page, but what keeps it going? What keeps the poem going and moving so that it will eventually move us? And what keeps you writing after that point where it might have ended?
Thank you. I always write my first drafts fast and without looking back, and I don't care. I mean, I have to have a rhythm and a subject to start me, and I just scribble till I run out, and there's usually an ending in narrative, but in that kind of buildup that you find in narrative, and so that tells me where the poem is going to end, and then when I work on it, this is what I've learned from writing lyric poetry, is to keep going past that ending. And sometimes it's stupid, you know, nothing interesting comes of it. But when I was writing lyric poems, I'd have four lines. So where can I go next? Elsewhere is what I was learning. And where do I go after the next thing? Elsewhere. And so there's a certain, it's a different kind of logic to these lyric poems that I was, many of them that I was working on. And so I think it's the same thing with the narrative poems. I want to go, have I tied things together? Have I made it hard for myself? Have I put myself in a corner, which is what most poetry does, you know? You said resolve, but I know you didn't mean resolve the issues in your life, but at least put them out there for yourself to examine. Mm-hmm. And so I come to, the narrative brings me all the way through. It's what happens in between, or what happens, what I end up putting afterwards, is the more challenging and interesting part.
Mm-hmm. And you said in an interview one time that you didn't think that you told stories exactly correctly, and there was kind of a quirk that you have of getting sidetracked, and in that way it became almost a habit of form. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, it's just... Is it a form? It's a method of development or
a process.
A process of, it's how you'd get from one thing to another in a poem. And reading a straightforward chronological narrative, unless you're reading fiction, and it's kind of boring in poetry. So mine just mirrors the meandering of my mind that associates. It's left branching. It just goes around. And I have to fix these things up later, and sometimes they have to create segues. But I think it's the way my uncles used to have conversations. You know, they'd sit down with their big cigars and a drink, and they'd be telling stories and you just couldn't follow them. Because they went here and then they went over there and then someone would interrupt and they go back. And maybe I learned that way. But what I'm doing is mirror, because I do write very quickly on a first draft. I'm really just mirroring the meanderings of my mind. Hey, not bad. and when I run, but when I run out of story, usually the poem is going to fail. If I can't find a reason in narrative for continuing with his story, which happens to be quite a bit, then the project, I'll put it away and maybe something will happen later. But that's another thing I liked about the lyric poem. To start with nothing, of four lines, and or to take a narrative poem that I didn't like, but it had these great four lines, I thought. Great four lines in there. And then to build a poem around it, in front of it and in back of it. That was interesting. Or to take two pages of a bad narrative poem and end up with eight lines from within it. Mm-hmm. And that was the poem. And it was a lyric poem.
So kind of excavating the poem out of the draft of the poem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did some of that. Yeah. But then when I learned how to, when I learned more about, when I started to understand some of the lyric strategies that I could take, I did it in as many ways as I could.
Mm-hmm. And made a reliable process out of that.
Yeah. Although what's fortunate is I'm a moron and I forget what I've done. And so I have to rediscover what I do every time I do it.
Wonder it takes 8 hours a day.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it takes 8 hours a day because I'm slow and because, I don't see everything right away. I don't take any distance from the poem as I keep drafting it. It's not a good idea, but I'm right up close to it. And so I don't see sometimes. So you just cut the first half. And so I end up putting as much work into a poem that's not going to work as I do into a poem that's going to work. A bad poem, mm-hmm. same amount of hours, days, months, as a good one. I mean, I'm working on a bunch at the same mm-hmm. time, so.
Yeah.
Does that?
Which is a good function of a studio. It sounds like you have a functional studio that you can enter each day, whether or not there's going to be something productive at the end of it, and that you trust that.
Well, it's my office. I write in my office 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And, but unless I'm in the middle of two or three drafts at the same time, which happens, but doesn't happen all the time, like today. And you're not a poet unless you're writing a poem. And you don't know where the next one's going to come from. And another one came to me today. And then by the end of the day, I said, no, I don't think this is going to do it. So there's a lot, you all know if you're an artist, that there's a great anxiety if you don't know what's going to come next. Mm-hmm. So I like it best when I'm in the middle of three or four different poems, different rough drafts or less than rough drafts. Right.
Thank you. This is a question I'm going to direct at Jane, but I think that maybe others of you have thought about it too. How do you deal with the tremendous power of traditional forms and genres to reinscribe familiar arguments about the world? It seems like there's almost an ideology that comes, or a baggage of ideology that comes with a traditional form. So how do you work against that power of the form to reinscribe familiar arguments about the world? And how does that play out? And I know, Jane, you and I have talked about this some, especially in terms of confessional poetry, or whether you want to write from lived experience, the idea of narrative itself, the arc of a narrative, seems to posit that it's possible to make a kind of order out of the chaos of our lives. And you, I think, especially in your book Midnights, have resisted that the lie, the fiction, that order would come by simply writing up the events of a life.
What was the question?
How do you deal with the tremendous power of traditional forms and genres to reinscribe familiar arguments about the world and do something else instead?
Well, I have a very easy time of avoiding form. I think it's because I have a lot of order in my daily life. I eat regularly. And I try to exercise regularly, and I try to pay close attention to the people I love. And so as an artist, I have no regard for order, diligence, attention of that sort. I do have a lot of attention for my work, but it isn't ordered at all. In fact, after having an office near Steve Orlin for over 20 years and have to watch him go in there every day, create something every day. I mean, I could just strangle him. The guilt and regret that I have over not being able to live that kind of a life as an artist. But of course, one goes on in one's own way. And so for me, anything formal that I do has to sneak up on me without my being aware. And eventually, it is the last thing that I pay attention to, and I have to, so I do. But I write in a very messy way and try to pull it together at the very last moment. I don't know whether that answers your mm-hmm. question, but
yes, it does.
It's an ordeal to face the sense of stanza organization or over the long haul, and I've actually forced myself to write very long books, so I would have to have an overarching order there to find. Even having at one point written a book of essays that almost killed me because I could not make order out of it until the very last moment, and with a lot of help from many, many people. My students, my peers, and you, in fact, Barbara.
And Allison can jump in here. She's very accomplished in two genres. She writes essays and poetry, and I imagine struggles with the conventions of both.
Of course, we all want to always be doing something new, and I never want to be. What was the terrifying phrase about the old arguments? You know, here we go again. Let's say it one more time. Uh-huh. What was that awful...
Reinscribing the familiar arguments
right.
about the world.
I mean, of course, none of us want to be doing that, and it's a terrible shock when you do something that you think is very new, and you look at it, and you said, I've been saying the same thing for 20 years. How did that happen? And so is how it's been about 5,000 other people I can think of. But nonetheless, one is under the obligation to try to make it new on one's own terms and in one's own forms. I have a different relationship to order, actually. I have tremendous sense of artistic chaos. I do think that writing poems and essays and lyric essays are all about creating order. I don't necessarily mean imposing a false sense of order so much as I mean how do we find a temporary sense of order that encompasses more of the chaos with which we're forced to live because of the time in which we live. And I think when we're struggling for form, we're struggling for some sense of temporary order and pattern that helps us to feel, you know, even as in this little poem I read, that there is a whole of which this chaos is a part, and somehow artistic form is one of the ways we metonymically create a sense of the whole of which all these fragments are a part. So just to say one other thing about that is that sometimes, because this spins off of the last thing Steve said, how do you keep the thing going when that's the question and you don't know how to do it and you've got a pile of chaos on your desk? Sometimes for me, it is a formal challenge. And particularly if I'm working on a long poem, I'll just say, I'll come up with some arbitrary thing I want to do. Like there's a long poem called The Flight that's about 20 pages long in my new book, and it's got a six-line stanza that steps in like the Williams triadic line, for those of you who know it, except it goes six times, and it's got all these different ideas of flight. And every time I got stuck, I just tried to say, all right, you're going to stay with this form. You're just going to keep going with it. And you're also going to stitch it together with this little word, so. So if you get stuck, you know, and it's a little joke about sewing, but it's S-O. And so the poem sort of gets stuck and runs out of steam, and I pick up the next gesture by saying, so, I'm waiting for the plane to take off. And you can connect anything to anything with one little word, and then it becomes a kind of unifying gesture that I don't think is an imposing a false order. It's allowing a word to help you create a pattern that feels orderly. So, I don't know. That sort of spins off.
Right, and simultaneously the poem is unraveling itself as well as stitching itself together.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Continuing with the aesthetic decisions that we make as poets, and thinking about this chaos issue, you know, we certainly encounter enough chaos in the world, and sometimes that creates enough sorrow that we need to write. But this question sort of flips it on its head. When you write, do you preserve or destroy your source materials? Anybody want to answer
Preserve.
That?
I'm a hoarder.
Okay.
What do you mean by source materials?
Okay, well, Allison answered that in terms of her process materials. Like, right? You keep the drafts. And
fewer, but I use a computer.
And that's an interesting answer and interpretation of the question. I was thinking more, for instance, if your source material is your third grade year at a Catholic school, when you write about that source material, do you preserve it or do you destroy it if you write out of a lived experience?
I've gotten further and further away from the source that starts me to write the poem. You know, uh-huh. Might be my third grade teacher. And I've gotten myself, my autobiographical self appears less frequently as an engine in the poems. It may have started that way, but I take that out. And I mean, I've got poems that where the whole thing was changed. And then I got into fictions that are personalized. Mm-hmm. But that I've lived a part of that. And so I'm creating three quarters of a new character, and and the rest is my voice. But I end up destroying it more and more as I've gotten older. Mm-hmm. You know, who cares about myself? You know?
Mm-hmm. Jane, what about you on this one?
I care about my small self. Not over much, but I try to get farther and farther into myself until I blast out the back, where I hope there's some sort of communal archetypal human that I can connect with. But I have to go all the way through the material, and I try as hard as I can to be honest. Just exactly as I remember it, and if I can't remember, I wait, and then I wait more, and I just rack my brains trying to get every single angle of it until some design comes through that is, humane in the sense that it belongs to more than just me. You know, it's sort of Jung's idea that, you know, if you get down to the bottom of your dreams, you'll find archetypal imagery there. It's shared and communal and in interesting. So I don't think I'm interesting, but I think that which I have in common with everybody can be terribly interesting if I could just find it. So while I'm looking for me, I'm looking for you. I'm looking for us.
Yeah. And Boyer, I think that you might want to add something to that. At the same time, I've seen in your work a kind of shift from telling stories and working from lived experience that you may or may not preserve or destroy in the process, in Arbolus, your first book, or in Taboo, your collection of essays. But kind of on the heels of that question, why do you tell stories if you do? And why do you work from fragments if you do?
My source material actually is language, is fragments, is stuff that I collect and cull in recent years from anywhere I possibly can. And when life is good, everything seems usable. I collect in notebooks. And then when I'm feeling the sort of confidence, I can't write every day, but I consider myself a writer as long as I'm collecting. But when I feel the confidence that I'm ready to make the kinds of spontaneous connections that will lead to something that matters, then I start combing through the notebooks. And depending on whatever conventions I've decided to work through, the shaping works against the sort of tension of the materials. And it's my life does come forward from time to time. Remnants is primarily a sequence of poems built on five individual separate sentences under a title that connects them in some way, though they don't tell a story or provide a single argument. My hope is, and my thinking as I created each one, was that there's a range of resonances among them, and that it leaves a kind of floating or indeterminate set of possibilities in relation to that title. So I've really moved away from story, but if one reads this, I think, from beginning to end quickly, you begin to see there are characters actually who recur. There's landscape that is very central to the sequence as a whole, and a kind of a very indirect story with the only themes I know, Eros and Thanatos, are present. In the end, it doesn't arrive at a different place thematically, as far as I can tell from my first two books. But I did feel also after Taboo, which has autobiographical essays, that I simply couldn't do that again ever. That I had gone into places in as direct a fashion as I could, and it was really a form of difficulty I didn't want to do again and didn't think I needed to. And so it was a long process coming to the new material and the new process of writing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers.
Yeah, it does. You know, in talking with you, it's clear that your work is incubated in a life story for all of you. And one of my questions about community has to do with, quite simply, are you a citizen poet or a private poet? Anybody who teaches has one leg in community automatically. You know, you are in a classroom. And so I would like to know if you have an answer to that question, are you a citizen poet or a private poet? But also, sort of in conjunction with that, looking back over all the classes and the classrooms that you've been in and you've been teaching in, what choices have you made over time that make you the teacher that you are, or make you the citizen poet that you are?
Well, I love teaching. I love my job, but it has gotten in the way of my work. And so it's become my work, and that happened to me. And so I'm grateful now for it, but I've fought it all the way. I feel that I'm a very private person, so I entertain and try to be as controversial as I can in the classroom so that I can leave it all there. And I'm just exhausted at the end of every class. I can't remember what happened. And by the time I walk about 35 feet, it's as if it never happened. Which is part of my process. I just have to just get it all out so that I can go back to my deepest self again. And thank you for understanding me. I'm sorry I haven't had you all over for dinner, but this is why. As my friend Richard Kotrover says, love you a lot. But honestly, I've always admired the poet William Merwin, who would have been, and he still can choose to, would have been a great teacher and walked away from that because he felt like it would take too much out of him. It's taken almost everything out of me to be a teacher because I wanted to be a really good teacher. And so I've just, like all of us here, you know, we work really hard at what we do, and I know that we're very proud of it. But for me, if I don't get away from you all now and then, I have nothing, no self at all to bring to the classroom. So I try to get away as much as I can, as far as I can, and as deep into myself as I can. And so the answer is I wish I could be a better political person. I have come out for certain causes so far out that, I don't know, I like to think that when I have to, I will be there. But it really is like pulling teeth. I remember when I first came out as a gay person at this university, it was sort of, I don't know, like scandalous. This was back in like the 18th century or something. In other words, it's just like it is now. Everybody thought it was just sort of brave and outrage. And I didn't really notice that I had done it. So I guess I am political, but not really when I mean to be. And so... thank you for respecting my privacy.
It's really curious what happens in a life. You know, I was a teenage mother and pretty much emotionally disowned from my family. I ran off to northern Vermont. I was a welfare mother and raised my daughter myself and worked for Planned Parenthood and other women's healthcare organizations. That was like 15 years of my young life. So when I came into university life, it was very late. You know, I was in my mid-40s. So I don't feel the same way about universities and teaching that some of my colleagues do. Have been doing it since they were seven, you know. And so that's a good thing. But it's weird. The really strange thing that's happened is I was a very private poet and wrote in the closet for a long time. And it was an amazing discovery earlier in my life to feel the social pleasures and the social function of art and what it meant to share poetry and the experience of poetry and the love of the poetry and the craziness of poetry with other people and loved it. I mean, how thrilling that was for me. And also thrilling that when you read your poem, people's eyes get bigger. And I mean, you realize you can bridge something between people with it. It's a staggering realization if you've written by yourself for many years, as most of us have. And over the years, that's gotten stranger for me because I didn't plan to become a public poet or a citizen poet, but it's something that happened. It came out of my work that more and more people kept asking me to come and do a reading for this environmental thing or for the Fish and Game Department of Florida. I'm thinking, what? Okay. And, you know,
and
so...
you're a poet laureate for zoos now.
Yeah, I'm a poet in residence at the Jacksonville Zoo in Florida, one of five poets around the country putting poetry installations up in zoos. So this evolved, and I can't tell you how much I love it. The feeling that people are doing really hard work to try to soften the brutality of human beings on the natural world want what we do, and it has meaning for them, and we don't always know exactly why or how. But it's true. It really does. And so I've become more and more committed to participating in these kinds of things. And so I now believe much more strongly than I could have possibly 20 years ago or even 10 years ago in the possibility for some poets and writers to really be out there and be a voice. In a way, I could go on for 7 weeks. I got one more thing to say and I'll stop. But I mean, I think one of the things we've learned through the terrible era of George Bush is that having data and empirical knowledge does not help us solve the terrible wounding and the terrible problems and the terrible diminishment of the world. Data doesn't do that. People don't care about climate change and they don't care about the extinction of animals because they don't feel it keenly enough. we bring the heart into everything. And so there's a role for us, and even the science communities are asking us to bring that into the conversation. And so, you know, I'm caught constantly now in that challenge of how to remain true to the really private and inner calling of being a poet, and at the same time give something to those communities who want a poetic voice in their particular social and political struggles. So, anyway.
Thank you.
Short answer.
Yeah. Well, and the way that you describe yourself, Steve, is kind of like the introvert poet. I think we're all recovering introverts, those of us who write. But we teach. We're in our classrooms. And there's another aspect to this notion of being part of a community, and that is that we publish. And, you know, when I was in my MFA program, there was a lot of talk about, well, who are your influences, and what are the origins of your work, you know, the source materials. Like, we've talked about some of those. But so this next question sort of pushes it a little bit. Much has been said about the origins of poetry in cultures and in individual artists' lives. What interests me more these days is the destination of what we write. No matter from where you launch it, where is it that you want your work to land and to detonate? That makes you a political poet or a citizen poet too, or at least it's launched out of your living room and somewhere else. And unless it's going into a time capsule, where do you want it to be? Where do you want it to explode?
Yeah. I just remember, is that on? No, it ain't on.
Yeah, there it is. I speak from green. It's great. We're under the interrogation lamp here. The sun is just blinding us. No, maybe she should. Yeah. I can't see these beautiful people for dreams. Auden said this great thing about poetry is a poet is someone who writes things by himself or herself in a room and to be read by another person sitting by himself or himself alone in a room. And so, so that's who my audience is. I want someone else to follow my thinking and see if there's anything interesting about it. And I always wanted to move people. Less now, I think. I want people to feel and think, but not necessarily break out into tears, which is what, that was my goal when I was a young poet, make you cry. But so that's my audience. I'm not a political person. I avoid confrontation. I don't feel like I'm part of any community except about a dozen friends who are all over the country and we talk on the phone. I mean, some are here too. But I'm really happy for the Academy that gave me a job. I'm good for nothing. I'm good for nothing. My father asked the principal of junior high, should he take Latin or French, which will help him get into college? And he said, you don't have to worry about your son going to college. He's going to jail. And he hung up on him. That's a true story. So I have a, even though I spend all this time in my office, I feel very uncomfortable in the Academy. I like to teach. I like to sit down with a group of people if they're nice and if they're smart or smarter than I am, which I have this semester and last semester. I've been lucky enough to have. Before that, I was going to retire because everybody was nasty. But
that's what he means by postmodernism.
Yeah, right. So I don't, I mean, I'm just a parasite here. You know, I give something to it, but what teaching has done for me is to help me, force me to articulate what I do intuitively. Mm-hmm. I do it intuitively on the page, but one has to, and the students have to do the same thing, is to then articulate it. And the older I get, the less good I'm at it, because I can't remember what I used to know. And my students will say, well, that should, you know, do such and such. I say, oh, yeah, I remember that. I used to say that, too. So the forcing to articulate. Plus, I enjoy people. You know, I like to see their lives and see their lives as they come out in their poems.
Yeah. And Jane, you answered this question in print one time in APR, January, February issue, 2008. This issue about, you know, where your poems are launched from and where you want them to land. So I'll read a little passage that you wrote, and then maybe you can add to it and update it, since now it is 2010. But you said, confessional material launches these poems, and you were talking about poems in Midnights. But the destination is an emotional panoply, a spreading out, my version of continuing my life as a painter in poetry, which in part is what I have always done. That is why, in particular, it is such a pleasure and an honor to have a master artist such as Beverly Pepper, who contributed the artwork to the publication of Midnights. The human figure and human heart have always been central in my work, starting points and process. These autobiographical elements launch or lurch outward, spreading by way of disassociation, distance, faulty memory, music, the transformations of dream, all of the distortions and refinement of improvisational composition, and finally become other, or just enough other, for me to see and to work with.
Well, I think I may have said that, I'm not sure. I think that your question, the beginning of the question was where I would hope these would land, these distortions. I would hope to have a very young audience. I don't know if it's possible. But whenever I speak with a young reader or someone new to poetry, who is not young in years but new to poetry, it's always very exciting. If any of this lands in someone's young mind, I feel really thrilled. And I've had some experience with that teaching here in the undergraduate program, where anything lands, not just my own work, but where a poem will land in a very young mind and just alter the mind considerably and quickly, and it's very magical. I think it's one of the great rewards of teaching, to see how quickly that can happen. And it's a reminder, I hope, to me, but to anybody who wants to be reminded, to remain young in that way, and to be able to respond so wide open.
Boyer, we've talked about this a little bit. I remember one time when my book, Desire Reclining, was just about ready to be published, and Gail asked me if I was excited about, you know, what was going to happen when it came out. And I looked at her, and I said, Gail, I consider publication the end of the process. And I think I was young. I was very naive, in a way, about my own sense of myself as a citizen poet at the time. And I don't think I'd answer that way anymore, although I don't have illusions about going on big book tours. But Boyer, when we've talked about this, we've talked about the urgency to publish manuscripts that we've had that we've finished and put in a drawer, or finished and showed to publishers who, for one reason or another, didn't snap it up, and yet our books keep coming. And so where are you on this question of where we know where it comes from, but where is it going?
Well, I certainly want readers, and the sense of community from reading and having others read my work is is a powerful motivation. But I have a sense that I would really, I mean, ideally, this is ridiculous, but I would love to be a part of the contemporary conversation about the nature of imagination. I would like to be somewhere in the stream of things that are happening right now with the language. Language is, of course, in a constant state of motion, and I don't want to fall into some. I really want to be a part of what is happening now in naming the world, so that if sometime in the future somebody comes back and happens to find something I wrote, it will in some way reflect through a sensitivity to the way in which imagination continues to grow and shift where we are now. It's an abstract ambition. Mm-hmm. It's not. You know, the person down the street sitting alone in the room. It's more a sense. I have this vision of language as a kind of, I don't know, almost liquid field, mm-hmm. and I want to be a part of that as the currents shift and turn as long as I'm alive.
Yeah, and now more than ever, it is possible to upload our work into the culture. You know, whether, you know, with the internet, I mean, whether or not you get a card catalog, you know, number from the Library of Congress, it is possible to do that and to interpolate our own thoughts into the larger conversation. And I think that that's part of teaching too, is letting students know that they have the agency to do that if they want to, that it's available with pretty low, you know, production costs. Well, thank you for entertaining my questions, and it's time to entertain some questions from the audience, so we'll take questions from you.
Wondering if you could talk for a moment about poetic concerns that maybe you've moved away from since you've been writing for a while, or poetic concerns that seem to have stuck with you through several projects.
I wish Barbara would answer this question for me. But I wish I could say that my themes and interests have changed, but I don't know that they have. I'm interested in tragedy. Suffering and the transformation of tragedy and suffering into a kind of higher consciousness. I used to think that I've said this in classes, I used to think that the function of art was the transformation of sorrow, but I now think it's a transformation of consciousness. But in the sense that I'm interested in transformation, I don't think that my subjects have changed very much.
I, the poems I've written in the last several years, they're all about men, women, love, sex, marriage, and I realized that I better get out of that as the only thing. And I don't usually force, you know, challenge myself thematically or subject-wise, subject matter-wise, but I have been doing that lately, and it's been kind of interesting. Is to take a public, to find myself in a public issue. Like, I've been working on a poem where historic, deep history, deep history is the wrong word, but it's historical, archaeological, going way back, and seeing how it relates to now. It doesn't make any sense because you don't have the poem, but I'm running around a museum with this little old man, a docent in a little provincial museum in an unnamed European country village, and we start to talk about the relics in there. Now, that's not my usual subject matter, and but I had such a great time. I wasn't in the poem, and so I told my wife, hey, I'm working on this great poem, and I'm not in it. She said, no, your poems have to have you in them, and she's right, that I do best with that. So I nudged my way into it. That's all. Oh, the other thing that's stayed the same, though, is same as Boyer, especially Boyer and I share a passion for rhythm and song. And for me, it's syntax and line that go along with that. Those are the mechanical, technical variations that I have the most fun with. And I work on those and hope that new subject matter, new lines will come in, because that line's too long or the syntax doesn't feel fulfilled, so I have to make something up. That's formal. It's just like you got to rhyme with something. It's, you know, syntax has its expectations. You can predict by the first three parts of syntax where it might possibly go, and you can feel it when it ends. That's a sentence. And I started writing long sentences because I didn't know how to start new ones. You know, I mean, it just was something I couldn't do, start a new sentence. Sometimes I have to look at a book of prose or somebody else's books, figure out what the new syntax was going to be in the next line of the poem. So I started writing longer sentences. And, I find when you're working on a formal issue, stupid stuff gets out of the poem. You say, well, it's too many syllables or stresses or the line too long. So you have to take out a couple clauses and then you realize, oh, I didn't need those. Anyways, that's that.
Time for maybe one more question. Well, if not, we also have plenty of time to buy books. I forgot to mention that the U of A bookstore is here with books by our poets. I want to thank Barbara so much for organizing this panel, Life and Letters, Allison, Steve, Boyer, and Jane. Let's give them all a round of applause. Thanks all for coming. Appreciate seeing you here. Come back next week. Sinan Antoon. Much to enjoy at the Poetry Center, and hopefully we'll have another installment of Life and Letters very soon.